You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of the Montreal Mafia Murders by Adam Leith Gulner, with illustrations by Nicole Rifkin. Make the bodies disappear. 2 weeks later, on June 30th, 2016, the Faldudos returned to Saint-Jude. The couple, as agreed, was making the usual din. The day before, according to the body pack recordings, Vio had brought Foti 4 boxes of hollow point bullets from the hockey bags. The Frenchman relished hollow points, which flare open on impact. They mushroom, he noted. They don't pass through the body. They stay in. When the two cars pulled into the driveway of the country home, the radio was outside, hanging from a tree, its volume knob cranked to the max. The tractor was running in the background, and Dion was cutting down trees with a chainsaw. It's like a B-movie, the Frenchman would recall. The Faldudos entered the 3-door garage. Vio watched through her front window. Walking in, the Frenchman looked pointedly at Foti. Let's do this. Foti just stood there, frozen. He had his gun, but, again, he couldn't pull the trigger. The Frenchman, seeing Foti choke, whipped out his piece. He shot Vinny first, in the head, then Joey, in the back, as he tried to run. The Frenchman jumped over the trunk of the car to finish Joey off, then turned back to Vinny. A hollow point was coming out of half his face, like an effing thing from a Halloween movie. When the gunshots died down, Foti started crying. They'd killed 2 young men. For nothing. For some money. Dion rushed in, alarmed by the commotion. They got him to fetch a roll of plastic. Vio brought cleaning supplies. The Frenchman instructed her to sponge the blood rather than wipe it up. Otherwise, the blood residue will stay. Foti looked at him, trembling. How are you staying so calm? If we get excited, we're going to make mistakes. As he and Dion rolled one of the corpses onto a sheet of plastic, it suddenly moved. The Frenchman jumped. But it was just dead nerves, causing electrochemical twitches. Dion, who lived around farm animals and abattoirs, continued wrapping the bodies in disconcerting silence. Foti then told the dumbfounded couple they would need to get rid of everything. How? They'd figure it out. They were to bring the car to a guy named Guido. He'd scrap it. And like that, the 2 hitmen left. Dion looked at his wife. What were they supposed to do with the bodies? She wasn't sure. Had she or they said something about making them disappear? She tried the bag of nails pager. Foti didn't respond, nor did he contact her that evening or the next day. In the end, Foti never came back and never brought them another penny. They were stuck with the debt he owed them and with the bodies. A double-double. They'd known something was going to happen, but not like this. Not in their garage, not with the mob ghosting them. As Vio put it, there was no after. The gang that couldn't shoot straight. 3 years later, on July 4th, 2019, the Frenchman pulled up to a rural La Belle Provence restaurant at sunset. He ordered a poutine and a double cheeseburger, then asked the cashier if she recognized him. His face said something to her, but she wasn't sure what. He'd lost weight, he conceded. He'd started dyeing the gray out. It's been a while since then, with the fireman, he offered. I was at your place a few times with Foti. The Italians? Oh, Lord, she gasped. Vio had closed that chapter of her life. Dion and she never spoke about it. Someone had come at some point to take the weapons and the bag of nails box, and that had been that. She'd kept on making hot dogs and fries, but now the killer had suddenly reappeared, like a hare in the soup, as she put it. The two sat in a booth and talked for 2 hours. He'd had a rough time since they'd last met. "Knives in my back from every direction," he said. She understood. In the intervening years, she said, she hadn't spoken to Foti or her sister Stephanie. Foti had officially been promoted to capo after the Falduto brothers were murdered. As the Frenchman explained to Vio at La Belle Provence, and as he would later testify at her trial, Foti then tried to kill him several times to silence him. According to the Frenchman, the Callies had always missed or bungled things. The gang that couldn't shoot straight, he called them. Noemi, even though she'd lived with the Frenchman then, had been in on the assassination attempts, he claimed, and conspired with Foti to do him in. Whether or not Noemi was actually involved in any plot, this much was certain. She left the Frenchman on Christmas night, 2016. Stephanie and Foti had also broken up by then. At first, it looked like the Callies had accomplished their goal. After the Falduto's ambush, they'd wrestled control of the city's mob operations, and Sal Scopa promptly flew to Calabria for meetings. That fall, Canadian law enforcement learned that the Scopas had received the backing of Italian crime syndicates and were the current leaders of the Montreal Mafia. Their hold on power, however, was far from secure. In September 2016, Andrew Scopa was recorded by police telling his driver, "It's hard to stay on top. It's a new world, chap. Everybody wants to take your belt." A month later, when Andrew was arrested on narcotics charges, the Callies imploded. They turned on each other, from the top dogs to the flunkies. "A scrumble," Foti called it, on one of the body pack recordings. Everybody was paranoiding with each other. Nobody went to see nobody. Everybody became crazy. It was during that time that Foti allegedly added the Frenchman to the menu. According to the Frenchman, Foti also wanted to kill Vio and Dion and burn their property down. When his underlings botched a hit, mistakenly slaying Stitch's father instead of the son, Sal Scopa put Foti in the hospital. "Like a ping-pong ball he was throwing me," was how Foti put it. "The chandelier got ripped down. He's hitting me with the chandelier." Per the Frenchman's account, Foti then did his best to shut Sal's lights. When a rival hitman shot at Sal in the winter of 2017, injuring but not killing him, Foti was on the premises. On that summer evening at La Belle Provence, the Frenchman's stories had the effect of making Vio open up about the Faldudos. Her shoes had been drenched in blood, she disclosed. To clean the garage, she'd emptied 8 containers of bleach. "Our eyes were burning," she said. They'd used 3 sets of saw blades to grind the murder weapons into tiny pieces, which they'd tossed while driving around the countryside. They dumped the loaner car with a man named Guidou and never heard from him again. "What about the bodies?" "I did everything like a good soldier," she assured him. "We burned everything." It had taken 6 cords of wood, enough to heat a large home for an entire Canadian winter, and 4 cans of gas. The bonfire raged for an entire day. They'd even needed to cut down more trees in the middle of the night. "You don't understand," she went on. "They weren't burning, man. I took the pickaxe with the shovel to go in. Listen, my heart was bawling. The pickaxe to open them up. Guy's seen people burn because he's a fireman. He never burned anyone." Even so, the two of them got it done. "Me, I'm the brains," she said. "He's the muscle." In the aftermath, They dug up that section of the ground 1 foot deep because of the oils and the this and the that, then refilled it with other soil. They threw the cinders and whatnot into the river. She'd known how to take care of business. Deal with it. Thank you. Good night. Don't talk about it again. It's over. But what did they get for it? F all, she said. Not even a visit. Nothing. Niet. Nada. Catch and release. Over the next 2 months, the Frenchman visited Bio and Dion several times. He also reconnected with Sigmund, the Acura driver who'd been hiding out with his mother. Foti, to their knowledge, was also underground. But then, on September 10, 2019, the Sûreté du Québec released photographs from 3 years earlier, showing Solicito's two killers on their motorcycle. They broadcast the images on social media and news outlets, requesting assistance in identifying the suspects. That morning, the Frenchman found Sigmund at his usual hangout, Café Red Room, having breakfast. "Did you see the news today?" He thrust his phone toward his compadre. "Look at this, a-hole." Sigmund squinted at the screen. "If they're asking the public for help, it means they have nothing," he argued. "They're fishing." "No, this is the effing game they do. It's catch and release," countered the Frenchman. "They have info." He knew Foti still had the motorcycle. He also knew that he and his father were laying tiles at a Sheraton just north of Montreal, not far from Solicito's murder site. It was the same hotel where several months earlier, Sal Scopa had finally been cannolied, shot dead in the crowded lobby on the night of his son's first Holy Communion. "We're going to talk to Foti," the Frenchman decided, despite the handful of times Foti had supposedly tried to have him killed. "Tell him you have to get rid of the bike. Chop it. They're looking for the effing bike." He and Sigmund beelined it to the Sheraton. The Frenchman had made it a point to wear a tank top, shorts, and flip-flops so nobody would worry about getting whacked. "If they see me all geared up, they're going to think I'm the effing messenger of death," he told Sigmund. They arrived around 9:30 a.m. "What's going on?" Foti's father asked, flustered. Foti looked up from his work as the two hitmen approached. "We're all cool?" he asked nervously. "No contract on me?" "You're safe, Jesus Christ," said the Frenchman, gesturing to his outfit, then bringing out the police notice. "Come on, look at this." "When did that come out?" Foti asked. "This morning, bro," replied the Frenchman, adding that it was all over TV and Twitter. Seeking privacy, they huddled at the hotel's rear loading dock area. "But why now? This thing, why now?" Foti wanted to know. Telling each other not to freak out, none of us are hot, they examined the facts. The cops were looking for two unidentifiable individuals and a motorcycle. "You know how many motorcycles there are," argued the father. Foti conceded that he still had the bike, but he changed its parts, so no cops would be able to identify it. "Are you a ding-dong or what?" asked the Frenchman. "You have to destroy it," Sigmund insisted. Foti tried to reassure them. "This is the triangle right here, right? As long as we keep our mouths shut, we're good." There were others, though. Namely, the fireman and the cleanup woman. He'd paid them, right? "I don't have that kind of money," Foti protested. "Sal never gave it to me. What am I supposed to do?" "What about the weapons from their garage? I swear on my mother's head I have every bullet and every effing gun," Foti said. As they spoke, he suddenly realized the urgent need to get rid of them, too. "Pa," he cried out. "It's all under my name, Pa. Imagine something goes wrong. They're going to put me away for 100 years. They decided the Frenchman would retrieve the hockey bags from Foti's storage locker and sell whatever he could. "We split everything," he said. "Me, you, him, and Marie-José. Everything down the line, fair and square." The two assassins drove off and debriefed. Foti would trash the bike. they would move the weapons. Foti was a different person, the Frenchman told Sigmund. He knows he made a mistake with you and me. He got more relaxed as we started talking, Sigmund said. He was honest about a few things, except about him trying to whack me. Foti had that morning denied being behind those attempted hits. Yeah, mumbled Sigmund, who remembered when the Callies had asked him to take out the Frenchman. The only reason you didn't go down is because of me, Sigmund confessed, explaining that he, too, had been part of the plan to whack the Frenchman. I couldn't do it. I couldn't understand it. It's breaking a code within me. To start betraying each other and the gang? No, 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 no. It's not going to end up good. The Frenchman, it so happened, had been betraying the gang for months. He'd approached the police to become an informant. And when they first heard his tale, it seemed so extraordinary, full of so many ludicrous blow-ups, they scarcely believed it. A sergeant detective named Daki Termidor spent weeks cross-referencing related murders to corroborate the facts. Termidor determined that the Frenchman's claims were true. As an undercover agent, the Frenchman agreed to wear body pack equipment to capture others inculpating themselves. Termidor oversaw the transcriptions of those conversations, portions of which read like dialogue from a Coen Brothers screenplay. After the Belle Provence encounter and the Sheraton summit, Termidor's colleagues retrieved the cache of weapons from Foti's storage locker. More than 100 officers worked on the case, which was dubbed Project Premeditate. On October 16, 2019, police arrested Foti, Sigmund, Dion, and Vio. 5 days later, Andrew Scopa was killed, shot in the face in a strip mall parking lot. Based largely on the body pack recordings, Sigmund was sentenced to life on 2 counts of first-degree murder and of conspiracy to commit murder. He has appealed. In those tapes, Sigmund spoke of the fate he saw awaiting Foti, an ugly death, as he put it. Andrew Scopa, before his own grim demise, shared that opinion. It's not going to end up good. The Frenchman, despite 3 murders and a lifetime of crime, got a handsome haul to turn state's evidence. $450,000, plus lodging and a weekly stipend, ostensibly for his marijuana consumption. Pressed about his drug usage on the stand, he admitted having a $1,000-per-week habit. He also testified that he occasionally microdosed hallucinogenic mushrooms, claiming they relieved his flashbacks. I'm in the middle of reliving each experience I describe here. I dream it as though it were the moment itself. Compared to the others, he seemingly had it made. But for all that, the Frenchman couldn't help ending up back in jail. In this case, for allegedly harassing members of the police, as well as Noemi. Convinced that she and Foti had tried to have him killed, he'd wanted her arrested for attempted murder. He grew obsessed, claiming the police had promised to investigate her as part of his compensation package. They refused to charge her. Noemi had a restraining order placed against him. He then ended up being the one charged for making death threats. When a defense attorney implied that he might be an unreliable witness because of payments he received, he snapped. This was for vengeance. It wasn't for money. You understand English or French? I did it for the effing vengeance. The secret of the gods. Vio and Dion's trial took place in a high-security judicial center attached via underground tunnels to Montreal's Bordeaux prison. Throughout the winter of the trial, as cross-examinations stretched on, snow squalls turned the sky the same grayish-white as the icy ground, creating the effect that the courthouse was floating in a kind of mist. Vio and Dion both chose to testify, insisting that, fearing for their lives, they'd lied in those scabrous recordings. They hadn't actually burned the bodies, they told the court. They'd made that up so the mafia wouldn't think they'd made mistakes. In reality, they said, they'd driven the car with the plastic-wrapped corpses in it to Guido's house and promptly left. The prosecution undermined that account, asking why, if Vio was afraid, had she looked out the kitchen window during the murder of the Faldutos? Why had she brought bullets to Foti? Why had she suggested having drinks with the Frenchman when he resurfaced? Why had she tried to hook him up with a friend or considered going into business together? She wept throughout the trial, folding and unfolding tissues, rotating them clockwise over and over. Dion, for his part, told the court that his now 18-year-long relationship with his wife had improved as a result of the homicide charges. "The fact that you were arrested for two murders is what improved your relationship?" the incredulous prosecutor asked him. "Yes," Dion replied, explaining that the ordeal had helped them start communicating more openly. Those born on New Year's Day, like Vio, 1975 in her case, are said to be lucky for life. But in the end, the jury found her guilty of conspiracy to commit murder and second-degree murder, bringing an automatic life sentence. Dion was unexpectedly acquitted. She had claimed, after all, that she had been the brains. Dion, ever the strong and silent type, hadn't said much on the recordings, whereas she had said far too much. Her testimony, the judge noted, strengthened the prosecution's already overwhelming evidence that established her involvement in the conspiracy to commit the murders and her participation in the murders by aiding and or abetting them. After the verdicts, Vanity Fair interviewed Crown Prosecutor Isabel Poulin. Even if Vio were an accomplice to murder, did she really deserve life behind bars while the actual squeezer walked free? "We believe justice followed its course," the prosecutor replied. Vio and her defense lawyer, Mylène Larrot, disagreed. They have appealed, but the court has yet to decide when, or even if, she will be retried. And yet another twist, Vio has been granted conditional liberty pending those proceedings. As she poses no security risk, the Court of Appeal ruled, and may ultimately be found innocent, a scenario the presiding judge described as realistic, she is presumed to be living once again at the family home in Saint-Jude. Last fall, Foti stood trial for the 2016 murders of Rocco Sollicito, the Falduto brothers, and yet another member of the Stitches. When the Frenchman testified against Foti, he couldn't hold back from calling his former partner names, rat, imbecile, cockroach. Moreover, he accused him of various other crimes, the precise details of which are under publication ban. Foti's defense team seized on the fact that the Frenchman presented inadmissible testimony in a prejudicial manner. The judge, for his part, declared a mistrial. A second trial for Foti is tentatively scheduled to begin in March. Whatever the ultimate verdicts, Foti undeniably led Vio down a tragic path. She has already been found guilty of murder, a conviction that will hang over her, Dion, and their family for the rest of their lives, whether or not her appeal is successful. Still, it seems fair to wonder which version of her is the real one. At one point, while divulging the grisly details of the Falduto murders to a man she believed to be an underworld associate of the Frenchman's, actually an undercover cop, she leaned in and told him while the tape machine was running, "You're stepping into the secret of the gods. You know your life is in danger. You know that I can do it. Don't be scared." But since her arrest, Vio has pleaded otherwise. "Christ, when I run over a baby cat, it takes me 4 days to get over it. I wouldn't go murder someone." the Role of Her Life. A new biography reveals the details of Elizabeth Taylor's lonely battle as activist during the AIDS crisis and her struggle to persuade her famous Hollywood friends to help. By Kate Anderson Brower, with opening photograph by Helmut Newton. Who's Afraid of Elizabeth Taylor? The Star, photographed by Helmut Newton at her home in L.A.'s Bel Air, 1985. And she's all dressed up, reclining on a chaise longue, looking as beautiful as ever. At around 4 p.m. on a Friday in 1998, Elizabeth Taylor, the most famous movie star of the 20th century, was dressed in her nightgown, applying makeup, and showing her friend Dorothy Flagler, a salesperson at Van Cleef & Arpels in Beverly Hills, a magnificent new yellow diamond ring. Flagler sat cross-legged on the floor of Taylor's bathroom as they chatted away. But when Taylor's assistant, Tim Mendelsohn, walked in and told them that a friend of a friend had passed away from AIDS-related causes that day, the mood in the room changed dramatically. "He really doesn't have anyone, and he has no money," Mendelsohn told them. "There was no money even to bury him." Taylor told Mendelsohn to get her business manager on the phone because she wanted to arrange for his burial. Mendelsohn called his office and was told that it would have to wait until Monday. When he relayed the message to Taylor, she threw the brush she was using down on the bathroom counter, and her eyes went wild. "We will not effing wait until Monday. We will do it right now. Get him on the phone again. I want to talk to him. No mother's son is going to lay on a cold, hard slab for the weekend when I can do something to stop it." When Mendelsohn called him back and handed her the phone, Taylor made her message crystal clear. "I don't care what time it is. Get that money over to the funeral home now." She was just as furious as she had been in 1985, 13 years earlier, when she became the most high-profile and most dedicated celebrity to shine a spotlight on a virus that was ravaging the gay community and further isolating people who were already ostracized by society. She had been fighting against injustice most of her life. "The most awful thing of all," she famously said, "is to be numb." In 1944, when she was 12 years old, Taylor played the lead in National Velvet and became a heroine to girls around the world. She was the last star created by the Hollywood studio system, and her global fame is rivaled only by a handful of other women, Jackie Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, and Queen Elizabeth II. Kennedy, who was fascinated by Taylor, withdrew into a private world. Monroe collapsed under the pressure, and the Queen was buffered by the walls of Buckingham Palace. Taylor, by contrast, flourished. In 1963, when Taylor was just 31 years old, The New Yorker magazine's film critic Brendan Gill noted that she was less an actress by now than a great natural wonder like Niagara or the Alps. She made 56 films and 10 television movies over nearly 60 years, but her lust for life has eclipsed her professional accomplishments. She is famous, even infamous, for her 8 marriages to 7 different men. By the time she was 26, she was twice divorced and once widowed. Her stardom was organic and so much a part of who she was. Long after she stopped acting, the drama surrounding her personal life was on display on magazine covers at every supermarket checkout counter in the world. But beneath the psychic clutter of her own mythology was a bawdy woman quick to laughter and self-deprecation. What is most remarkable about Taylor is not how she maintained a stratospheric level of celebrity. It is the way that she singularly turned it into a force for change that saved countless lives and inspired so many others to follow her lead. "I resented my fame," she once said, until I realized I could use it. It is impossible to overstate the fear and bigotry surrounding HIV and AIDS in the 1980s. Crosses were burned in front of AIDS patients' houses. Postal workers refused to deliver mail to people with AIDS, fearful that any human contact could spread the virus. A government worker burned her dress after handling an application touched by a person with AIDS. People would not eat at restaurants if the waiter was gay. Children with AIDS were being cast out of their communities. People living with HIV and AIDS were being denied jobs and life insurance, and they were completely alienated and ostracized. The disease confounded the medical community. It was a mystery that in its earliest years was ravaging the bodies of previously healthy young men. On July 3, 1981, the New York Times published an article, "Rare Cancer Seen in 41 Homosexuals." By the end of that year, 337 cases of the lethal disease, thought to be a rare cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma, were diagnosed. In 1982, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention referred to the virus for the first time as acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS. In 1984, 130,400 new HIV infections were reported globally. At first, no one knew how the disease was transmitted. The July 1985 cover of Life declared, "Now no one is safe from AIDS." President Ronald Reagan did not utter the name of the disease until that September, and then it was only to respond to a reporter's question. In 1987, U.S. Surgeon General C. Everett Koop called for the use of condoms and sex education to prevent the spread of the virus, which cripples the body's immune system. But it was not until the spring of 1987 when Reagan gave a major speech about AIDS at Taylor's urging. By the end of the year, 40,809 Americans had died. Almost at the exact time, a reactionary backlash rose, led by figures like Anita Bryant and Jerry Falwell Sr., whose moral majority fought against recognizing the rights of gay people. Homophobia was rampant, and AIDS became known as the gay plague. The virus devastated the entertainment community and spread to hemophiliacs and injection drug users. Taylor was watching helplessly as many of her friends were dying. The word empathy comes from the German Einfühlung, or infeeling, translated first as empathy in 1909. It means mingling your own feelings and consciousness with someone else's experience, which had always come naturally to Taylor. She possessed what her stepdaughter Carrie Fisher called rampant empathy, and she was feeling powerless until she found what became her life's calling. Bill Meisenheimer was the director of AIDS Project Los Angeles, and he knew that he needed Taylor's help. There was no one who commanded as much respect within the entertainment community, and he knew that she had many close gay friends. In 1985, he met with Taylor's assistant, Chen Sam, and asked if Taylor would agree to chair a fundraising dinner called Commitment to Life to benefit APLA. The dinner would be the first major celebrity fundraiser in the world for AIDS. Taylor was constantly being asked to help raise money and draw attention to different causes, and she wanted to make sure that everything she did had a clear purpose. In the end, Meisenheimer said, he had to present a note from the philanthropist Wallace Annenberg, who was working with APLA, to prove to Taylor that they were a legitimate organization committed to helping AIDS patients. Once she was convinced that APLA was an honest organization in need of her help, she was on board completely. Unlike today, there were very few celebrity activists, and Taylor was among a handful of other actors and musicians who championed causes and drew attention to issues. Among them were Jane Fonda, who had been the most vocal and high-profile celebrity anti-war activist during the Vietnam War, Harry Belafonte, who helped organize the Selma to Montgomery March for Voting Rights in 1965, and who still works on behalf of civil rights and social justice causes. Eartha Kitt, who fought for civil rights and LGBTQ plus rights. Audrey Hepburn, who was an ambassador for UNICEF. And Paul Newman, who was a Democratic activist and philanthropist. In the early days, it was a lonely battle. Studio heads, whom Taylor had made lots of money for, hung up on her. Worst of all, her friend and former lover Frank Sinatra turned her down when she first asked for his help. Michael Jackson was also hesitant. So many people made excuses not to help that it shocked her. Some of her friends and advisors told her to stay away from HIV and AIDS because it could end her career. "Who gives a goddamn about careers," she told them, "when the people without whom we wouldn't have a career are dying?" Taylor fired the first and most audible shot in the long ongoing war to eradicate AIDS when she hosted the dinner and raised $1.3 million for APLA on September 19, 1985. Eventually, more than 2,500 people showed up, including Shirley MacLaine, Sammy Davis Jr., and Carol Burnett. There were also AIDS patients at the dinner who could be easily identified because their tuxedos hung loosely on their bodies. "She was very, very sweet," Burnett said. "She cared for people. Yes, she was rich. Yes, she was beautiful. Yes, she was famous. But it did not go to her head." While she was waging her battle, Taylor must have been thinking of her close friends, Montgomery Clift, James Dean, and Rock Hudson. "If it weren't for homosexuals, there would be no culture," she said. "The idea that God should choose his children to suffer, his geniuses to whom he had given the talent to make it a different, more beautiful place for us mere mortals, made me so angry." She was definitely thinking of Hudson. While she was planning the Commitment to Life dinner, Taylor learned that he had AIDS. Publicly, she said that she found out when the world did, on July 25, 1985, 2 months before the September dinner. But in reality, she'd learned days before. "I thought Rock had cancer. Then one of his doctors called me and said, 'Listen, I shouldn't be telling you this, but I know how much you love him, and I'm going to because I'm not sure how much longer he has. Rock has AIDS.'" Hudson's announcement helped mobilize Hollywood's elite into action because one of their own was sick. It helped make the dinner such a success that the venue had to be moved from the Century Plaza Hotel to the Westin Bonaventure because they needed a bigger ballroom. Taylor, an optimist, started to become cynical. "Why," she thought, "do people care more now just because someone who's rich and famous has it? When I found out that the ban had been lifted because of Rock, everybody could hardly wait to come to the dinner to show that they were broad-minded," Taylor reflected later. Hudson bought $10,000 worth of tickets, but he was too ill to attend, and instead sent a telegram that was read aloud that evening. "I am not happy that I am sick," he wrote. "I am not happy that I have AIDS. But if that is helping others, I can at least know that my own misfortune has had some positive worth." Hudson's doctor, Michael Gottlieb, said that he was told by his bosses at UCLA, where he had been treating Hudson, that Hudson would be discharged. "Rock Hudson will die at home," they told him. "He will not be readmitted." Gottlieb knew the reason why. They did not want UCLA to be known as an AIDS hospital. And Hudson did die at home on October 2, 1985. He was 59 years old. Since there were no effective treatments in the early and mid-1980s, APLA used the money from the dinner to focus on patient care. Taylor's love and support was necessary during the early dark days of the epidemic. Meisenheimer said that at APLA, he and his colleagues would do interviews outside their office because television reporters were too afraid to come inside. AIDS patients would sometimes be discharged from the hospital to APLA because they had nowhere else to go. Meisenheimer and his staff would put them up in a hotel nearby. "I do know that she comforted me in tears often," Meisenheimer said of his friendship with Taylor. "She was so passionate and so compassionate. I've never been starstruck. I respected the legend of Elizabeth Taylor, but I loved the woman." In the summer of 1985, while working on the Commitment to Life dinner, Taylor thought about creating a national foundation to improve patients' lives and raise money for a cure. She met with Gottlieb, Meisenheimer, and Chinsam at an inconspicuous French restaurant in Santa Monica. Meisenheimer picked Taylor and Sam up in his brown Honda Accord and chauffeured them to dinner. "We were an unlikely group," Gottlieb recalled. "Me, a doctor who spent his life in laboratories. Bill Meisenheimer, a Xerox executive turned activist who was openly gay and the greatest living movie star in the world." But that night, it all gelled. Meisenheimer told Taylor how hard their path ahead would be, and she took his hand in hers and said with tears in her eyes, "Don't worry. I've been through a lot." This was the moment that led to the creation of AMFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research, the first major nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting research on AIDS. AMFAR's first incarnation was the West Coast-based National AIDS Research Foundation that Taylor, Gottlieb, Meisenheimer, and Sam created that evening. Rumors of the foundation reached Dr. Mathilde Krim in New York. Krim was a well-expected and fiercely dedicated research scientist who was married to movie executive Arthur Krim, a friend of super producer Mike Todd, who was Taylor's third husband until his death in 1958. Krim had created the AIDS Medical Foundation, which needed money. She reached out to inquire about a merger. In his will, Hudson left $250,000 to Taylor's National AIDS Research Foundation. And 2 days after the Commitment to Life dinner, representatives from the National AIDS Research Foundation and the AIDS Medical Foundation met in Los Angeles to try to find a way to join forces. When they announced the creation of their new foundation, AMFAR, at a press conference, the power struggle between the two groups was already evident. It was to be based on both coasts. Taylor was the national chairman. She did not want to be called chairwoman, and Krim and Gottlieb were chairs. Krim admired Taylor's commitment and her dedication to treating AIDS patients with dignity and respect. But her ultimate goal was always to find a cure. When Taylor could get on the phone and make an impact or travel for an AIDS fundraiser, she did. "People always ask, 'Does Elizabeth Taylor work hard?'" said Meisenheimer, who became the first director of AMFAR. "You've got to put it in perspective, because what's hard work for Elizabeth isn't necessarily what everybody else would call hard work. Once, we had a board meeting at the Bank of Los Angeles. Afterwards, she said, 'So this is what a bank looks like.' She'd never been in one." Sally Morrison, who held top positions at AMFAR for 13 years and worked closely with Taylor, said that Krim and Taylor were powerful women who had a common goal, but different ways of getting there. Dr. Krim was very empathetic, but to her it was so clear, "We needed to address this problem through science," said Morrison. "I think for Elizabeth, it was very difficult not to address food and housing and patient services. She had a lot of friends who were sick." The war was only beginning with the creation of AMFAR. In 1986, the conservative author and longtime friend of Reagan, William F. Buckley Jr., wrote an op-ed in the New York Times calling for people with AIDS to be tattooed on their buttocks and arms as a means of private protection in order to identify all the carriers. Buckley said that Taylor was no hero, but a living example of self-indulgence. But Taylor could not care less what Buckley or anyone else thought of her. In 1987, she gave a speech at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and reflected on what had made her become an activist. "I became so incensed and personally frustrated at the rejection I was receiving by just trying to get people's attention. I was made so aware of the silence, this huge, loud silence regarding AIDS, and no one wanted to talk about it, and no one wanted to become involved. Certainly no one wanted to give money or support, and it so angered me that I finally thought to myself, 'Bitch, do something yourself, instead of sitting there getting angry. Do something.'" In 1987, Taylor launched her first perfume, Passion, and followed it up in 1991 with White Diamonds, another enormous hit. She traveled around the country, visiting the department stores that sold her perfume, and she vowed to visit AIDS hospices in every city that she could. But there were two caveats. She did not want any press to interrupt those private visits, and the perfume company and the department store would have to donate money to each of the hospices she visited. She vowed to match their contributions. At the Coming Home Hospice in San Francisco's Castro District, nurses were told in hushed tones that Taylor was on her way. She stopped in each of the hospice's 15 small rooms, and she spent several minutes talking with each patient. She asked them if she could arrange to have their dogs walked. She asked if she could call their mothers for them or write letters for them. "Some patients cried when they saw her," said Guy Vandenberg, a healthcare worker and AIDS activist who was at the Coming Home Hospice when she visited. After she met with patients, he said, Taylor sat with a handful of staffers in their tiny kitchen and asked them how they were taking care of themselves. "How do you support each other?" she wanted to know. "They averaged 3 deaths a week in the 15-bed hospice," he said. "Sometimes I would get my 3 to midnight shift and I would come back the next day, and 1 or 2 people might have died during the night," Vandenberg said, his voice cracking. "The need was so great that the bed would not be empty more than a day at most. Sometimes the bed would be filled right away. We didn't have time to process the volume of death." Next photo, Truth to Power. Taylor testifying before the Senate in 1986, making the case for increased spending for the fight against AIDS. "Even amid all the darkness, there was joy. A majority of our patients, as they were dying, were quite capable of laughter and gallows humor, and to an outsider, that often felt really strange or inappropriate. When the hospice was taken over by a more corporate hospital, we got disciplined for too much laughter, and we were eating with the patients, and that was not allowed," Vandenberg said through tears. "She fit right in. She knew that was good. She joked with them. She hugged and kissed every single one of us, the patients and the staff." After one of her hospice visits, a patient woke up and said, "I had a vision that Elizabeth Taylor came to me in my sleep." "No, she was actually here," a nurse told him. "Taylor wanted to look perfect for every visit. I hope I haven't overdone it," she'd joke. "So she always arrived with full hair and makeup, and the famous 33.19-carat Usher-cut crop diamond on her left ring finger. She wanted the patients to see her the way they had imagined her to be." She told her assistant, Georgette Strum, who would get emotional, that she could not come into hospices with her because she would start to cry if Strum cried. "She had to keep things light and happy," she said. "But she'd get back in the car, and she would bury her head in her dog's soft white fur and be unusually quiet for a while. Ed Wolf was a counselor in San Francisco General Hospital's Ward 5B in the 1980s. San Francisco was second only to New York in the number of AIDS cases, and 5B was the world's first revolutionary inpatient unit for people with AIDS. It was created in 1983 and run by registered nurses who specialized in caring for AIDS patients. In 5B, patients were treated with compassion. In the beginning, nurses and doctors wore so much protective gear that they looked like astronauts. Food trays piled up outside of hospital rooms because no one wanted to touch them. But in 5B, things were different. Nurses were not allowed to wear protective medical gear, including gowns and masks. They believed that physical touch was an important way to honor each patient's humanity. They did seemingly little things, like recreating the decor of patients' living rooms in their hospital rooms, allowing their pets to visit them, and, of course, allowing their partners to stay with them. They even used champagne glasses for water. "We couldn't cure people, but there was a possibility to heal," Wolf said. "We held weddings for people on their deathbeds years before it would ever become legal. In 5 minutes, families would find out their son is gay and he has AIDS. One conservative family from a small town came every single day for 2 weeks until their son died. They saw all these gay people taking care of him, and they did a 180. They went back to their homes and started a support group for people whose kids had AIDS." This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.